Hello, and we're back with Unusual Sources. Today we have a great interview with Anthony Fenton on the responsibility to protect. Since its adoption in 2005 by the UN, it's really evaded many debates, but finally, this July, there was it actually faced criticism from some of its major opponents. Today we have with us Anthony Fenton, co-author of Canada and Haiti, Waging War Against the Poor Majority. He wrote that with Eve Engler, and he has a great website called The Web of Democracy, and it can be found at www.webofdemocracy.org. Hi, Anthony. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay, great. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks.
First, I want to let our listeners know why the responsibility to protect is used to, and how it's used to justify military operations. I think one of the great examples is Canada's incursion in Haiti, and we were very involved in this. You've written really extensively on this, and I really want to know how Canada used the R2P doctrine to justify the invasion of Haiti.
Well, absolutely. We should go back just a little bit first, because it was in 2000. Under Jean Chrétien's government, the Liberal government had a majority, if anyone can remember back that long, when Jean Chrétien basically spearheaded the effort to create what would later become the R2P doctrine. This is important to note, as I try to, that it was through the funding of the Canadian government, the initiative of the Canadian government, and the funding of elite Liberal philanthropic foundations that enabled and gave life to R2P. Basically, R2P, as the critics that you referred to at the UN General Assembly's informal dialogue last month were, namely Noam Chomsky was one of them, and Jean Bricmont, the author of a fabulous book, Humanitarian Imperialism. They basically argued that this doctrine was developed to put sort of meat and potatoes to what has been practiced for centuries. You know, there have been R2P-like invasions. Basically, these are invasions that foreign powers undertake under the auspices of humanitarian intentions. So that we're talking about the question of humanitarian intervention. And the whole reason that this elaborate new structure, the R2P, it was called at the time the International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty. The reason that it was set up was to sort of flip the question on its head, because the traditional victims, as Chomsky said, are wise to the language of humanitarian intervention, and they were very wise to, for example, the invasion of Yugoslavia in the 1990s, specifically culminating in the bombing, 75-day bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999. And so they set up this commission to change the wording and sort of rebrand humanitarian intervention. And so if you listen to the R2P, what I call the R2P lobbyists today, they will tell you that, no, R2P is different from humanitarian intervention in the sense that instead of it being our right to intervene, it's our responsibility to protect populations that are at risk of what they say mass atrocities, ethnic cleansing, and genocide. And so you fast forward a few years, basically from 2000, when the commission was first funded and set up at the International Development Research Center, the IDRC in Ottawa, to 2001, just after 9/11. See, this sort of got sidetracked because of the 9/11 and the subsequent events, in the sense that the report came out just after 9/11, was largely ignored. But the Canadians and a growing core of advocates, who I call the R2P lobby, we're pushing for its implementation, holding conferences, engaging think tanks, engaging NGOs to get on board with this and build momentum and consensus around this emerging, what they call a global norm, the R2P. And so in the period before 2005, as you mentioned in the intro, when it was loosely adopted at the UN General Assembly, we had this coup d'etat in Haiti in 2004. And prior to that, though, your listeners may be familiar with the meeting, what are referred to as the planning meetings for the Haiti coup. That's not certain based on the documents we've received, but what the so-called international community, that is to say the European Union, Canada, the U.S., and France in particular did, was they would hold diplomatic high-level meetings without the attendance of any Haitians, and they would discuss the future of Haiti. And in some of these meetings, in one of these meetings in particular, in 2003, called the Ottawa Initiative on Haiti meeting, the R2P was invoked to justify, basically, in the event that it was necessary, you know, the intervention, the invasion of Haiti. And and in an interview that I did with the minister who had hosted that meeting at the time, Denis Paradis, he again invoked this R2P. Like, if anywhere in the world was a case of R2P, it's Haiti, right? And again, you can go back in history, and like, R2P was very much implicit in the U.S. occupation of Haiti begun under Woodrow Wilson back in the late 1910s. And so, but here again, we had Canadian leadership trying to invoke this doctrine, trying to legitimize it by using the case of Haiti. And of course, the case of Haiti is very instructive, as you said, finally getting to the response, is that Haiti was purposely destabilized. The democratically elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, which was elected in 2000, was purposely destabilized by the very powers, the so-called Friends of Haiti, Canada, the U.S., France, the Organization of American States, using that. They were undermining the very government that they would later say they had to intervene in order to fulfill the responsibility to protect. And when they finally did create the conditions for the overthrow and removal of that democratically elected government, which culminated in late February 2004, we saw what is a sort of like the extreme nightmarish version of what R2P could look like in future interventions. We saw a U.S. Marines, we saw the Canadian Joint Task Force 2, we saw the French Gendarmerie, we saw the Chileans go in and invade, remove the elected Haitian president, and then chaos and terror swept the island as thousands of Haitians were murdered by a paramilitary resurrected death squads from, you know, Haiti's former army and police. And that is sort of, well, you know, that's a long story, of course, in detail, yes. But that's the culmination of what R2P, sort of how it manifested in Haiti after 2004. And that's one of, you know, one of the articles I wrote was the danger of R2P, the case of Haiti, because if future interventions were to take any semblance of the form that they took in terms of the R2P invasion of Haiti in 2004, then this spells trouble for popular movements, spells trouble, yes, for democratically elected governments. So they're deemed to be enemies of the West. You know, and so we look at who are the biggest enemies of the West today, Latin America and the Caribbean alone, Cuba, you have Venezuela, you have this recent coup in Honduras, you have
yes,
Bolivia and Ecuador, and these are potential R2P cases, and this is where we've actually seen the most sort of pushback in opposition to R2P, culminating in this recent debate in the UN,
yes,
where we saw these critics raise their voices for the first time in a long time.
Definitely. Okay. I'd like to get a little bit of background also on how R2P, you mentioned that it was loosely adopted in 2005 by the UN without a vote. Can you just expand on that thought?
Definitely. A lot of the information about the process that took place in order to get the version of R2P that was accepted in the UN summit outcome document in 2005 eventually pushed through is coming out in the form of, like, for example, Paul Martin's memoirs, former Prime Minister Paul Martin, and a number of sort of historical overviews of the period that are coming out. But there was a lot of diplomatic arm twisting, a lot of promises made that had nothing to do with R2P in exchange for X country's vote. So Paul Martin was on the phone in the days before, you know, this is September 2005, basically pleading with some of the leading governments that were opposing R2P's inclusion in the document, and it worked somehow. At the end of the day, they watered down the language of R2P enough that it was acceptable to the majority of governments. They still didn't have a vote on it, a formal vote. And, in fact, President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, I believe, said that had they tried to have a formal vote, that would have been opposed and all hell would have broken loose in the UN at the time. But the main thing is, in fact, comes up in, I think, was just identified in a, in a column the other day by Noam Chomsky in response to someone who had written a pro-R2P column attacking Chomsky earlier this month. But basically, he points out that the doctrine itself, the 2001 R2P doctrine, and that was chaired again by Canada and an individual named Gareth Evans, who is the CEO of what's called the International Crisis Group, sort of like a humanitarian imperialist NGO that receives most of its funding from these very same foundations that funded R2P and the R2P lobby network. But basically, Chomsky points out that version didn't get pushed through, and in that version is where much of the controversy can be found, in the extent that it says in the original 2001 doctrine that if the Security Council rejects a proposal for an R2P invasion or fails to deal with it in a reasonable time, alternative options are action within area of jurisdiction by regional or sub-regional organizations. That is to say, coalitions of the willing, like NATO, because NATO's writ is increasingly a global writ, right? It's no longer the regional organization that it was once purported to be, but it's now becoming an organization that's the sharp end of the so-called global war on terror, and that's the key sort of difference. So, a watered-down version. The countries that were opposed to R2P's inclusion in 2005, they did so tentatively anyway. Basically, their understanding was, okay, we're going to allow the wording to go into this document, but it's open for a remaining discussion. Nothing's been finalized. We're just going to talk about it, and then we're going to figure it out. But on the other hand, you had the R2P lobbyists, the advocacy networks, doing an end run around this ever since then, basically saying, look, R2P has been included. We got what we have to worry about now is what they call operationalizing the doctrine. Meanwhile, you have the opponents and skeptics, and rightfully so. We're talking by skeptics the whole anti-colonial world, the non-aligned movement, and so forth, the G77. And basically, they're saying we want to discuss it because there are legitimate concerns that haven't been discussed or debated. And meanwhile, the R2P lobby is basically trying to get it implemented and get it in place and make it so, create the facts on the ground to the extent that it's irreversible, that the process is irreversible. And so that's,
okay.
That was the significance of the debates, and that was 2005.
Yes, okay. So it's 4 years later. Now, there's a debate that has finally been allowed to come on the UN floor. Why did it come about now? And why did Chomsky and Brickmont decide to join in this debate?
What I don't know the backstory that brought Chomsky and Brickmont and Ngugi. What I can say is this. They were brought in at the behest of Miguel de Escoto Brockman, who's the president of the UN General Assembly. There for some time there had been debate within the United Nations over how to proceed. You on the one hand have this lobby network that's trying to push ahead with it. One individual that's closely connected to this lobby network, by the name of Edward Luck, he was appointed as the special representative of the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on R2P. And people within the UN General Assembly oppose this. They're like, we don't want to give you funding to finance an R2P special representative because we don't even know what's going on with the doctrine. We haven't decided yet. We don't even know if it's going to exist. And so there's this conflict that was playing out. De Escoto Brockman was able to bump back debates that I think had been scheduled for April, formal sort of informal debate on R2P, to finally have the dialogue they've been seeking. And somehow, because De Escoto Brockman as he himself pointed out in the introductory statement, Nicaragua has reason to be skeptical of R2P because they've experienced an R2P-like destabilization, invasion, themselves when the Sandinistas came to power, and they were undermined. They had the U.S. is funding a covert war against them, and then they destabilized the Sandinistas and got them out of power through so-called democracy promotion programs in the early 1990s. And so De Escoto Brockman created the space. He had three critics on the panel, and against the prime R2P lobbyist, as I mentioned, Gareth Evans, it was just interesting, as I noted, to see the shoe on the other foot, because one of the main tactics of the R2P lobby is to evade any direct form of debate with their critics. So they'll set up straw men in their arguments repeatedly throughout their documentation, their reports, and there's many of these. But they'll never really directly take on their critics, and so that's why this is very important.
You mentioned the lobby, the R2P lobby, and how I find it very interesting that how many of these developers and proponents are liberal philanthropists and many of the people that support them. Can you explain who these people are and why, you know, why they're supporting this doctrine?
Yeah. There's a really good sort of historical current in academic current of critics of philanthropic foundations as basically fronts for U.S. foreign policy or U.S. imperialism. And there's a really good, some really good literature. And one of the best books that was written was by Professor Joan Roelofs back in, I think it was just 2003, called Foundations in Public Policy. And it shows how dangerous a threat that these foundations have historically posed to democracy, both inside, you know, internally, say in North America, and insofar as they extend their tentacles globally, which is what they've done increasingly. Some of these foundations have global, like sort of what are equal to like an international development budget of a government, you know, and they're operating abroad, and they've worked very closely in concert with what other theorists have called the Imperial Brain Trust, which is all these sort of beltway think tanks, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Brookings Institution, the Hoover Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, these foundations that were the sort of upper crust of the elite foreign policy thinkers and sort of revolving door too, because a lot of these players revolve into government and out of government. But these philanthropic foundations have been sort of the lifeblood for these many of these think tanks, many of these imperialist organizations. So when it comes to R2P, you trace the funding back to its origins, and it was the major foundations that are always at the center of these analyses of foundations as imperialist front organizations, essentially.
Yes.
And they are the MacArthur Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, and among others. And one of the very most interesting things is that Lloyd Axworthy, who was the sort of one of the brainchilds of R2P, remember he was the guy who steered the human security agenda through the Canadian foreign policy process and made it sort of take root globally when he was foreign minister under Chrétien. He retired from politics and then played a role in the actual R2P commission. And then, after the R2P was released in 2001, a few years later, after it was adopted in 2005, shortly thereafter, he becomes a member of the board of directors of the MacArthur Foundation, which is the sort of the single most important financier of the R2P advocacy network. He becomes the board of director member who's responsible for overseeing the funding of R2P advocacy. And so it's interesting on the one hand to see the sort of the Canadian role, the Canadian-ness of the R2P doctrine and the whole advocacy coalition that's grown out of it. But there's another aspect to this that's interesting because, in fact, speaking to that point in particular, just a few months ago, Wesley Clark, mad bomber Wesley Clark, who was a U.S. general, you know, who...
Yes, and a failed presidential candidate.
Yeah, and he is housed at the UCLA Berkel Center for International Relations now. And back in, I think it was April, they had a conference on R2P. There's many of these university centers that have emerged as sort of R2P nodes on the R2P advocacy network, a place where, you know, you get the intellectual cohesion, the consensus building, and so forth. But he said... It's very, very illustrative of Canada's role in this, what he says here. He says, R2P, if it's closely associated with the United States, it looks like a pretext for intervention, and that's not the intent. He said, his recommendation to the Obama administration was You've got to be very, very careful with R2P, because if it gets out that this is the administration's formula for the next round of intervention, then kiss it goodbye. It's dead. So you've really got to keep your distance from it. So that's why Canada was instrumental to both introducing the idea with U.S., basically, you know, U.S. Philanthropic funding as well, but they were able to allow the U.S. to keep a distance from it. Meanwhile, many of the important players in the R2P lobby are liberal imperialists who come from that sort of current of the Michael Ignatieff, the Samantha Powers, the Michelle Obama. I mean, the Council on Foreign Relations in Chicago is one of the key centers. Michelle Obama's on the board of directors. The head of the Chicago-based based R2P coalition is from Chicago, a close friend of the Obamas, you know, and so one of the other dangers of the R2P doctrine is that under an Obama administration, because of the close affinity that we can see in his cabinet and we can see in the discourse, is that we're going to see this overt liberal imperialist turn, and the R2P is going to be, they're going to try and have it further entrenched, and as a sort of a, as Wesley Clark says, right, they'll implicitly support it, but at the same time, behind the scenes, you're going to have this, like some serious sort of deepening of R2P's effect on sort of international relations. And so that's where we're at.
Very interesting. I want to get to sort of the bones of the debate that occurred in the UN. And some of the major elements, it seemed, surrounded implementation of the R2P, as it will be used as a tool, as you mentioned, for powerful nations to invade the weak, you know, the United States. Chomsky questioned the doctrine of R2P and how it would it be implemented in every occasion of human rights abuses, specifically protected populations such as the Palestinians. Would not the situation in Palestine apply implicitly under R2P? And how is this addressed during the debate?
Well, yeah, absolutely. No, I'm not. I wouldn't say like, yeah, we should apply R2P to Gaza, right? I mean, because
of course not.
but you know what?
But under their conditions, it would have to be implied, right? So why wouldn't they want to apply it?
Right. Exactly. And then that's funny. I like many people, I'm sure, listening, like yourself, was glued to Al Jazeera in December and January of this year when Israel was pounding Gaza with you know, aerial bombardment and the ground invasion. And the destruction that wreaked upon Palestinians. And at that time, I said to myself, what are the R2P lobby saying about R2P and the situation in Palestine? Like right now, as they're under invasion, under assault. And go to all of the R2P lobby websites, and there was nothing said at all about Gaza. And so I called a few of them. I called the head of sort of the International Coalition for the Responsibility to Protect. It's now called, and he refused to be interviewed. But then I did get a hold of a man by the name of James Traub, he's a journalist for the New York Times Magazine. He's an author of a sort of pro-U.S. imperialism book called The Freedom Agenda. And he is also the director for policy of the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect, another Canadian and MacArthur-funded organization that they created to operationalize R2P. And he said at the time, it would only muddy the waters to invoke R2P because Gaza or the Israeli authorities are already under enough scrutiny and already under enough criticism, and there are already enough mechanisms in place through the UN that we don't want to belabor Israel. You don't want to invoke R2P unless your purpose is to belabor Israel. Meanwhile, Richard Falk, who's the UN's special representative on the Palestinian
and he was
territory.
Also involved in R2P.
He was one of the researchers. Yes. Yeah, and a fairly big advocate, but at the same time, one of these sort of liberal leftist advocates of it. But he said, you know, on December 9th, I think it was, of last year, before the invasion even, that R2P should be invoked in the case of Gaza, and that the Israelis were undertaking collective punishment against the Palestinians. And he reiterated when I spoke with Richard Falk in January during the assault that, yeah, if anywhere it applies, it's in Gaza. He says it's absurd, basically, that it's off the table. And the only reason it's off the table is because of what Noam Chomsky is saying. It's because it's off the table because the U.S. says it's off the table. The U.S. could stop by virtue of ending arms shipments, ending diplomatic support, etc., for Israel. It could stop the bleeding, could stop the siege of the Palestinian people whenever it wanted to, just like, and Chomsky gives this example, just like they did in East Timor in 1999, finally under Clinton, after decades of supporting atrocities and genocide there, they finally said, no, okay, that's it, and it stopped. And so there are examples of when the U.S.,
yes,
if it wants to stop, so there, and Chomsky's point also was that, like, in those cases, there didn't need to be, no one had to invoke R2P because all you need to do is just stop your support.
And it's already, many of these cases are already under the UN charter that you can actually do something under there. And this leads into my next case, my next question. The proponents of R2P, claim that this is going to prevent atrocities. And they use the old examples of Bosnia, Rwanda, Cambodia and Kosovo. I found Brickmont's response to this very interesting. And he basically said that we tend to question the lack of intervention instead of examining the pitfalls of intervention. And both Key and Chomsky really bring up the example of the Balkans. Can you give some more examples of that?
Well, yeah. I mean, in fact, that was, I encourage people to check out the Foreign Policy in Focus website, where Chomsky replied to an article by someone named Ian Williams, where Williams basically declared that Chomsky was factually inaccurate on the question of whether or not the NATO bombing facilitated more whether the number of atrocities sped up before or after the invasion, whether the NATO bombardment was a cause of atrocities. And Ian Williams said that's absurd. And then Chomsky goes and he quotes our friend Wesley Clark, right, who said in his memoirs that this is entirely predictable that the worst atrocities would begin as the bombing of Yugoslavia started. And so this is another case of the hypocrisy and the historical blindness or willful sort of ignorance on the part of the R2P lobbyists who refuse even these uncontroversial facts, which, as Chomsky has impeccable sources like Wesley Clark themselves prove that he was right. And in fact, just one more point on that, because there's another interesting critic of R2P. Now, he's not a critic of intervention per se. His name's Alan Cooperman. But he's done some research on this very question where he basically says that, and this applies to the case of Haiti as well, because he says that R2P historically has encouraged rebellions, and so it has encouraged rebellions that will provoke atrocities, ethnic cleansing, genocide, what have you, and that in turn exacerbates the conflict. So he cites the case of Yugoslavia, and you could cite the case of Haiti, where that's exactly what happened. There's this rebellion that was basically supported by us, and if we hadn't supported the rebellion, there would have been no coup, and the violence, the thousands of people that died afterwards, never would have been killed if we hadn't have supported the violence. So, the rebellion. So that's the key point there, I think, on that one.
Yes, and another element of the argument that Chomsky really brought up was that all of these examples are selective. And as you mentioned, Palestine will never be used under R2P. And other nations, you talk about East Timor and all these examples. Can you elaborate on this and how Chomsky was able to sort of bring this argument that how they're selective? And how did the proponents react to this part of the argument?
Again, yeah, that's the thing. Like it's so easy to do, right? I mean, it's almost laughable, Iraq's the case, right? The one case that they will mention, because Tony Blair made the faux pas by actually trying to say post facto that Iraq was a humanitarian intervention in 2004, and so the R2P lobby was backed into a corner. They had to say, look, we have to distance ourselves from any affiliation of Iraq and R2P, because sort of like what Wesley Clark was saying about U.S. Acknowledgement of R2P, that you just have to keep your distance from it. So it's very interesting, though. But the point is that there's so many historical examples that we could just tick them off, right? Go pick up William Bloom's Killing Hope, right? And all the case studies, the R2P case studies are in there. And so the important thing, what you ask is how do they deal with it? And again, even in the context of a situation where they're in the same room with their critics, they're there face to face with them, they'd still evaded it. So, for example, when Chomsky literally called Gareth Evans out when they had the post debate press conference, he basically said, because Evans was the foreign minister of Australia at one point, and his government supported the brutality in East Timor, and his government increased his support for the brutality in East Timor at the exact same time that NATO was bombing Serbia. And what was his response? He shrugged his shoulders. He said, "Don't let's play the numbers game, Noam." You know, and that's it. And he kept repeating that Noam Chomsky's just a cynic. And being historically conscious is to be a cynic, you know, and that's the point. And that was their only real defense. And that's sort of been the trend, to ignore or evade genuine debate and genuine criticism of their efforts.
Okay, finally, before we let you go, I think you've touched on this, the coverage in the media. You mentioned Chomsky's debate. Can you sort of illuminate a little bit more about how this debate was covered in the mainstream media, or how it wasn't covered in the mainstream media?
Yeah, there was quite a bit of coverage, you know, in general, but there were a lot of labeling of, you know, Chomsky and the Skoda Brockman and Brickmont, if they mentioned Brickmont at all, and Ngugi, I can't pronounce his name, the Kenyan writer who was also part of the debate. But the main thing was they're radicals, they're the critics, they're the ones who are, you know, they're supporters of absolutist sovereignty or authoritarian sovereignty and so forth. So The Economist had a piece that was really just a total distortion of both the debate and the reality of R2P. None of the type of discussion, you know, we're having here. But most of the newspapers had some sort of blurb on it. But it really isn't been treated as really hasn't gotten the coverage that it merits as what is a really important development within the UN system that is effectively sort of changing the character of intervention and state sovereignty, as they say, for the 21st century. And like, it's a fundamental, if this, you know, I think Chomsky would say maybe that it is irreversible. These guys get so much money that it's almost impossible to stop the momentum of this R2P lobby advance. But there is pushback taking place within the countries we've mentioned in the UN.
Yes.
It remains to be seen what's going to come of it, and we just hope that, you know, other this will somehow open up new debates and open up more space for people who are generally critical.
And as you mentioned, this is a really important issue for Canadians, as this ideology seems to have been developed in Canada. And you mentioned briefly, Mr. Ignatieff is quite a large proponent of R2P, and we'd love to have you back on the show to maybe touch on that subject next time.
Oh, absolutely. You bet.
Okay. That was Anthony Fenton. Anthony is, as many of you know, co-author of Canada and Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority. He wrote that with Eve Engler, and his website is Web of Democracy, www.webofdemocracy, all one word, .org.